Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to journalist and writer Sonia Purnell, author of A Woman of No Importance, The Untold Story of the American Spy Who Helped Win World War II. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In 1942, the Gestapo sent out an urgent transmission. She is the most dangerous of all Allied spies. We must find and destroy her. Their target was Virginia Hall, a Baltimore socialite who talked her way into Special Operations Executive, the spy organization dubbed Winston Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. In her new book, A Woman of No Importance, Sonia Purnell provides a close-up view into Hall's life and exploits. The first Allied woman deployed behind enemy lines. Despite her prosthetic leg, Hall helped to light the flame of the French resistance, revolutionizing secret warfare as we know it. It's an astounding and inspiring story of heroism, spycraft, resistance, and personal triumph over shocking adversity. Sonia Purnell is a biographer and journalist who has worked at The Economist, The Telegraph, and The Sunday Times. Her book, Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill, was chosen as a book of the year by The Telegraph and The Independent and was a finalist for the Plutarch Award. Her first book, Just Boris, was long listed for the Orwell Prize. Sonia Purnell, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, Sonia, let's start with the title of your book. Here is the woman of greatest importance in World War II, as history unfolds and tells the story, and her biography is labeled A Woman of No Importance. Why don't you help our listeners understand how that happened?
Sure thing. Well, that's really talking about her life both before and after the war. Before the war and after she lost her leg in a tragic hunting accident, she was repeatedly ignored, sidelined, rejected, undermined, was really having a very rough time and treated just like a woman of no importance. And you know what? Even though she had played such a great role in the Second World War, war had liberated her, she could show what she could do finally. But then again, after the war, when she went to work for the CIA, one of the first women to do so, again she was treated like a woman of no importance. Again she was sidelined and often humiliated, ordered to take instructions from male officers two ranks her junior. Even Howard E. Hunt, of Watergate fame, one of her colleagues, said that he couldn't bear the way that the sacred presence, as he called her, was treated. So it was just this one part of her life where war, the desperate nature of war, meant that they would take anyone, however talented, but help from whatever background. If she could do the job, that's all they cared about. But that was the only time, really, that she could show what she could do. And like you say, she was a great woman during those years. A lot of people in SOE described her as the greatest agent of the war. She was phenomenal.
So it's very interesting. Prior to the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor, America was not exactly excited about entry into World War II. Churchill was doing his best to convince Roosevelt. Roosevelt was dragging his heels because he could see the American people weren't ready for it. And yet here it is, 1940, when Virginia Hall leaves her plush life in Baltimore, and you can help us, you mentioned she's a Baltimore socialite, and tell us what she does, because she goes over to France. And this is while people weren't even sure we should be at war with Europe or with the Germans. And at the same time, she's way ahead of them.
I know, it is extraordinary. And I think this all dates back from when she was a young woman. She went to study in Paris and loved it, loved the roaring 20s, loved liberation of Paris. There was no racial segregation. There was no prohibition. She met architects and writers and poets and intellectuals of all sorts and just loved the way that she could lead a very free life. But then she went to study in Vienna, and that's when she saw the rise of nationalism, the rise of populism. And this always worried her, always disturbed her. She saw how the truth was being surrendered and ignored. And she wanted to be an ambassador, but I'm afraid it was very, very difficult. In fact, there were no women ambassadors at that time. She went to work for the State Department as a secretary instead. By this point, she had five languages and qualifications from seven different universities. She was highly qualified to be just a desk clerk, but she impressed again and again and again, but was always refused entry to the diplomatic service. So she found herself in Europe at the outbreak of war. She could easily have gone back to Baltimore at that point. She came from a well-to-do family. They had a very nice farmhouse just outside Baltimore. Absolutely, she could have gone back. But despite the fact that she'd had this hunting accident, despite the fact that she'd lost her leg, she wanted to do what she thought was right. So though America, like you rightly say, wasn't in the war, didn't want to get involved in the war at this point, Congress was completely against it, she personally wanted to help, wanted to get involved, wanted to stop the rise of nationalism and the rise of fascism. So initially she offered her services to the British Army and they weren't interested. She was a foreigner at that point. They couldn't take foreigners on. So she went to work for the French Army instead and was sent up to the Maginot Line, which was, of course, a few days later. We're now talking May 1940. A few days later was very much near the front line of the battle once the Germans started invading France. And that's when she was driving an ambulance to the battlefield, to and fro from the hospital, picking up the wounded under bombardment, under machine gun fire, against the flow of everybody else. There were 10 million refugees fleeing, and she was going towards the gunfire. And using this prosthetic leg was incredibly painful. It was a European ambulance with a gear shift. She had to keep pressing down with her left foot on the clutch in absolute agony. But you know, Virginia Hall was something special. A lot of the French soldiers were deserting, running away. She didn't. She kept going to the bitter end.
And the interesting thing about everything you've just said is that this is really almost a preface to the heroics that Virginia Hall displays once she actually gets behind enemy lines, once she aids and abets the French resistance, providing all kinds of leadership. I want to remind our listeners who may have heard me interview Pam Genoff for The Lost Girls of Paris. And by the way, that led me to two biographies of Vera Atkins. One is A Life in Secrets. The other is Spy Mistress. I have to admit, Sonia, that I really didn't know much of anything about Special Operations Executive until I picked up Pam Genoff's book, a novel, a fictionalized account of Vera Atkins and her girls, as they were called then. And I guess I'd love to have your perspective on the Special Operations Executive. Help our listeners understand the OSS and the Special Operations Executive in that era and what the Brits were trying to do at that particular moment of the war.
Well, sure. So, I mean, after she was demobilized from the French, she still wanted to find something to do through a chance encounter in a Spanish railway station, a billion to one chance. She bumped into someone who was an undercover British agent who put her in touch with SOE, Special Operations Executive in London. Now, SOE was Winston Churchill's brainchild. He remembered that awful trench warfare of the First World War, where thousands, tens of thousands of young men paid with their lives for a few inches of ground, only to be then beaten back. It was just a senseless, awful slaughter. And he wanted to think of a different way, a way perhaps where some of the rules would be broken, a kind of mixture of espionage, but also sabotage. So these people, these agents going into France, would sure, they would be sending information back, but they would also be ultimately forming networks that would one day become the resistance, because the resistance in France took some time to get going. It didn't just spring into being as soon as France capitulated. There were a lot of denunciations. It was very dangerous. So SOE wanted to form those networks to support the Allies or the Brits. At that point, it was really only the Brits when they finally came back into Europe, but also just to start those sabotage missions. This is a little bit later on where they blew up strategic railway stations, fuel reservoirs, German convoys, that kind of thing. So it was a kind of an unprecedented form of guerrilla warfare, if you like, secret warfare. And it was only going to be doable by the most extraordinary, exceptional characters. Now, this chap in Iron Railway Station noticed Virginia Hall, realised that she was American. I don't know whether or not he knew, noticed that she had a prosthetic leg, and knew, obviously, that her country was not yet at war, and but also thought here was one of those exceptional people who could deal with this kind of thing. Now, Essaouy hadn't managed to get anyone into France by this point after 6 months of trying. One guy had got into the plane, he was going to be parachuted in, and he bottled it at the last minute. He wouldn't jump. It was just too scary because when you went in, there was no backup, there were no contacts, you were entirely on your own. You were going to have to start this whole warfare from scratch. The Brits had no agents left in France at all after Dunkirk. So the Brits were completely at sea. They had no idea what was going on in France. This whole thing was as closed now as North Korea, perhaps even more so, if you can imagine that. But Virginia volunteered. She talked her way into Essaouy and she said, hey, you know, I'm American. I don't need to parachute in. I can go in by train, openly. But I will say that I'm a journalist. I will file articles for the New York Post who were brought in on the secret. And in those early articles, I will send you coded messages as I begin to set up my networks. Mm-hmm. Now, she went in September 1941, 2 years after the beginning of the Second World War, but still obviously before Pearl Harbor. She was given a 50-50 chance at best of surviving even the first few days. So you can see just how brave she was. She had had very little training, but she did have a license to kill. This is one of the few ways that she was similar to James Bond. She had that license to kill, and her favoured way of doing it was with poison pills, potassium cyanide pills, and I found a couple of signals where she asked for some more, so we can only assume that she did on occasion have to use them. So just to give you an idea, so a desk clerk from Baltimore rebooting the whole Allied intelligence network in France, that is just the beginning of the story, but my goodness, she was very, very good at this stuff.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Sonia Pernell talk about her book, A Woman of No Importance, The Untold Story of the American Spy Who Helped Win World War II. So maybe you could give us a couple of examples of just how she was good at this stuff, as you say. Heroics that really singled her out back to her supervisors in Britain as somebody who was the best they had on the ground.
Okay, so she was for a while the only agent, for a long while the only female agent. Other agents did start now coming in, but she set up these networks that were extraordinary, far-reaching, complex. She made sure that each network was small. In case one got compromised, it wouldn't compromise another. And she seemed to have a sixth sense and a charisma, a sort of personality that won people over. Everyone was scared. Everyone was scared of being denounced to the Gestapo. But she, although she was a foreign woman coming from who knows where, managed to persuade people to join up. And those people included a convent above Lyon, which became a safe house. The chief of the local police who tipped her off when they were ever going to be raided. Local businessmen who made their offices and their warehouses available as safe houses or storage places. The local brothel madam, who was an extraordinarily brave woman, and the women who worked for her, all recruited by Virginia. What incredible spies they made, too. She called them my tart friends. But also railway workers, people in the town hall who helped her falsify papers. So she started building up these networks in readiness for one day when the Allies would come back. But in the meantime, various other agents, including 12 male agents who were brought in, infiltrated into France, very important, sabotage experts, wireless operators, all sorts of very, very useful, highly trained male agents. Unfortunately, they broke one of the cardinal rules of security and all met up. She didn't go. So Sixth Sense said, I don't think this is a good idea, but they met up in a villa in Marseille, a port in the south of France, and I'm afraid it was a trap. Mm-hmm. And they were all caught, and they were tortured, and they were facing execution. And Virginia, no one else could get them out of prison. Virginia got all of them out in one of the most daring escape exercises of the war. She got them all out. She got them all into a safe house, and she got them all back to Britain. It was extraordinary, but no one knew about it. We've all seen the Steve McQueen film, The Great Escape, and most of those guys die. Of course, they didn't make it.
Yeah.
But in Virginia's escape from Mozac, a camp in the Dordogne in southwest France, they all got out and they all survived. And then slowly she was starting to put together some sabotage campaigns too. So this is what she started in the first half of the war. Now, the problem was that a priest, a double agent priest, one of the worst double agents of the war, one of the most successful, managed to infiltrate one of her networks. And it got to the point where she refused to leave so many times, but finally she accepted she had to go. And then that escape, her own escape from France, is one of the most thrilling episodes that you can imagine. And also, take into account, she had this wooden leg. She called it Cuthbert, a primitive hollow wooden leg held on by leather straps and buckles, which was incredibly painful. And yet somehow she managed to escape out of France over the Pyrenees, over one of the highest passes in some of the worst snows for 200 years. She was made of very strong stuff. It is really, really gripping how she got out.
Tell our listeners how she lost her leg.
Well, she was a young woman who had always had the adventurous soul. She was a free spirit. She had loved going hunting with her father as a teenager. And he, unfortunately, had died, but had given her a shotgun. She loved hunting. She was posted by the State Department as a desk clerk to Turkey, to Izmir, the Gediz Marshes, wonderful for hunting, particularly snipe, very difficult to hit because they have an erratic flight pattern. But she wanted to be the first very competitive woman. I think that's probably why she didn't notice that there was a wire fence running through the reeds of the marshes there. Beautiful December day, sunny, lovely. But she didn't notice this. And as she tripped and fell, she grabbed her gun and she hadn't engaged the safety catch. And she literally shot herself in the foot at point blank range. Now, initially, they thought it was going to be fine. She was going to be okay, even though there were little tiny pellets in the flesh of her foot. But then quite quickly, I'm afraid, gangrene set in. They had to call an American doctor and nurses from Istanbul. It took them 24 hours to get there, very slow traveling in those days. By the time they were there, it was clearly gangrene. Her organs were on the point of shutting down. There was only one chance of saving her, and that was cutting off her left leg below the knee, fortunately. And although she nearly died several times more, she somehow miraculously pulled through. But she was only 27. And as I say, a sportswoman, very active. This was truly just an incredible blow. But instead of giving into it, and she was often described as a victim in the press, she wouldn't. She decided that she had to make even more of her life now, that there was nothing that could hold her back. She was determined to show the world. In those days, if you had an accident like that, you were normally expected just to sit in the chair in the corner
really?
And lead a quiet life.
Yeah.
But, you know, Virginia was not like that. And she wanted to show the way that disabled people could still do the most incredible things.
In her days behind the lines and working with the French resistance, she was always one step ahead of the Gestapo. How was she able to use the sexism that she so frequently was subjected to in order to stay ahead of the guys?
Well, initially, it was certainly a help because the Germans and the Vichy police, the Vichy government being the French collaborating government there, they both were very conservative. They thought that women simply didn't get involved in dirty things like resistance or guerrilla warfare or spying. So they couldn't believe that, particularly an attractive woman, she was a very striking woman, Virginia Hall, they simply couldn't believe that she could be involved in something so underhand. And she was able to exploit that for some time. However, it did become apparent that there were now a lot of women playing some kind of role in the resistance, and the Germans and the Vichy police realized that and were no longer hoodwinked by that, if you imagine. And indeed, if they caught women, a lot of women were couriers with messages or weapons, you know, hidden in a baby's pram in one instance or in their pocket. But if they were caught, I'm afraid both the Vichy police and the Gestapo reserved some of their most brutal torture for women. I won't go into details, but it was truly horrific. And from going to being quite gentlemanly about it, they went to completely the reverse. And if anything, women were treated worse. And of course, they didn't have the protection of the Geneva Convention. They were not considered combatants. And so there was no protection for them at all. And there were some really, really gruesome, grisly cases, I'm afraid to say.
Yes, well, you read about some of those in your book. We are talking to Sonia Purnell. She is the author of A Woman of No Importance, The Untold Story of the American Spy Who Helped Win World War II. When did the Gestapo, Sonia, finally discover who they were hunting for, who I think they dubbed the Limping Woman?
Yes, that's right. They knew that something extraordinary, an extraordinary operation was coming out of Lyon. It became obvious. And after the major jailbreak that she was involved in, she did plenty of others, by the way, they realized that there was someone exceptional up against. Hitler himself was furious about this and ordered a huge clampdown across France and determined to find this person. Initially, they thought it was a man. Then they gradually realized enough collaborators denounced her and told the authorities who they thought it was, that they realized it was a woman. And like you say, the limping lady, she became very famous. And there was also this priest, who Robert Alesh, who infiltrated some of her networks, was getting closer and closer and finally actually met her in her headquarters in Lyon. And although she was unsure about him, her sixth sense told her he was dangerous, and yet he had all the passwords. He seemed to know so much about the people that she was working with, and he seemed to have such wonderful intelligence that she could send back to London, that initially she allowed him in that little bit. But I'm afraid he was in the pay of the Gestapo and the Abwehr, which was German military intelligence. He was making millions. He had a huge apartment in Paris, had installed two mistresses inside there. And he sold so many people so many very brave, heroic people to the Germans. And his ambition was finally to sell Virginia, but they wanted to get everything about her before moving in and arresting her. And that gave her her chance, her window to escape. But the Gestapo were after her to the very last moment. So she got over the Pyrenees with the Gestapo in pursuit, an extraordinary achievement for anybody, let alone a woman who'd been living in wartime France with virtually no food, with a prosthetic leg. An even more extraordinary thing is, when the Brits said, "We're never sending you back, we know that the Gestapo are after you, we know that they've got a photograph of you now, that they know everything about you, your name, everything you've done, we cannot send you back, you're too compromised." And so it was at that point that Virginia said, "Okay, I'm going to go and work for the American equivalent of SOE, which had been set up relatively recently, called OSS. And they were so delighted to have someone of such esteem, such experience. And so they said, "Okay, we will send you in, but you have to go in disguise." And that disguise was another extraordinary feat of hers.
Yeah, but it's tough to disguise a prosthetic leg, or at least the limp that goes along with it, right?
Absolutely. What she did was she disguised herself as a French peasant woman. She got Hollywood makeup artists based in London to show her how to draw very, very convincing wrinkles on her face. She had a London dentist to file down her teeth. She had nice white American teeth, and French peasants didn't, so she had her teeth ground down. And she wore big, thick peplum skirts to hide her Colt 32, but also so that her leg was completely hidden. And she taught herself to shuffle so that the limp was really not apparent. Previously, she'd taken big strides to try and hide it because she knew it made her very conspicuous. Now she shuffled and she spoke with a sort of a croaky rasp, you know, trying to pretend that she was an elderly peasant woman. This was her only protection. She had to walk past many times under the scrutiny of Gestapo patrols and German army patrols, and she had to keep in character. That was the only way that she could stay alive.
I want to back up a moment to the part about the double agent who is trying to find her and deliver her to the Nazis, and as you point out, eventually meets up with her. I'm reading this part of your book, and I'm thinking, did I pick up a novel or did I pick up a real live work of nonfiction? And the reason I say that is that this Robert Alesh that you're describing, the double agent, and everything you said about him, I mean, you kind of glossed over it, but he was a Catholic priest. I must say that that took me back a bit. I'm trying to figure out, were there many Catholic priests who were in cahoots with the Nazis and who had this magnificent apartment in Paris? I mean, it sounds like this guy in himself could be the subject of a incredible biography, not a very gracious one, I might add. But nonetheless, it's like, who was this guy?
I know, you know, when I was researching this story, Virginia's story, I couldn't believe not only her story, but the story of those around her, including Robert Alesh. And yes, I mean, there were some priests who were collaborators. There were others who were very brave and fought for the resistance with all their might. And, you know, at least two did a great deal for Virginia. But the very fact that Robert Alesh was a priest, you know, that's bound to put you off your guard a little bit. And he was said to make give sermons in his church in Paris that were totally anti-Nazi, anti-German. But it was all a front. And what happened was that young men in his congregation would hear him make these sermons and then go to confess to him and say, I'm helping, Father, I'm helping the resistance. I did this, that, and the other last night. And the next day, he would go and sell their names to the Gestapo or the out there, and they would be rounded up and shot. And this was this man. It is incredible he's not better known. He was a hugely effective double agent for the Germans. We don't know how many people lost their lives directly as a result of his activities, but it certainly seems a huge number. Now, I'm not going to tell you what happened to him in the end, but there was at the end of the war, there was a massive manhunt for him. And I'm going to let your readers find out, your audience find out in the book what happens to him. But he became a figure that the Allies had to track down at the end of the war. And that was down to a report that Virginia wrote saying, however plausible he may seem, he is absolutely dangerous. We must find him. And they did find him.
So let's talk about Virginia when the war is over. And like so many warriors, it's not easy just going back to being who you were once upon a time, especially if you've been a Baltimore socialite and you've been through what she's been through in World War II. So how does she try to craft a life after these incredible heroics of her French days?
Well, I mean, it was very difficult. I mean, particularly on that second mission when she went back in, because she was a guerrilla leader. She was blowing up British. She was liberating whole swathes of France. She was sending back intelligence that helped the Allies liberate Paris. I mean, she was a warrior, as you say. She was a guerrilla leader. And she was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross by America, which she was the only civilian woman to have that honor in the whole of the Second World War. President Truman himself was so impressed he wanted to give her the honor in the Oval Office to make a big song and dance about it. But do you know what? She said, no, thank you, Mr. President. You see, I want to go on being a secret agent. She was also decorated by the French and the Brits, but in secret. Because what she wanted to do, she thought, well, listen, the war let me free. I could do important things. I could show what I'm capable of. But peace was her, made her prisoner again. She joined the CIA. Absolutely. She was one of the first female officers in the CIA. But as I found out when I spent a day at Langley and looked at some of the her personnel files and things, she was treated very badly. She was sidelined and sort of overlooked, and no one really wanted to hear what she had to say quite often because her male colleagues had done nothing like she had done during the war. I think they felt threatened by her. I mean, after all, she had basically organized an army of schoolboys and vets and farmers that liberated a whole part of France. She'd armed and trained them. And now here she was sitting behind a desk, twiddling her thumbs, and no one really wanted to know. It was awkward. She had so much more experience than most of her colleagues and co-workers. So it was not really a happy time for her after the war. Although I'm really pleased to say she did find love. Paul, who was parachuted in to help her towards the end of the fighting, of French background, but she made sure that he was naturalized as an American. And her mother didn't approve of him. He had came from a very humble background, nothing like her own, but they did eventually get married and were happy together. But there was always this frustration that she wasn't used properly. And interestingly, the CIA now publicly recognize that, which is great. And they've now named a training center after her, and a lot of recruits are told about her when they start their training. And when Gina Hassel became the first female director of the CIA last year, she talked about how she put it on the shoulders of heroines who had gone before, who had had so much to do to battle down barriers and break through glass ceilings. And it was pretty clear that she was very much talking about Virginia. So in a way, Virginia's legacy is only now just beginning to be understood. In fact, only a few weeks ago, she was introduced into the U.S. Commandos Hall of Fame, and she's been dead for 40 years. And it's just a shame, in a way. She didn't want publicity, but she did want respect. That was all she asked for, and she didn't get enough after the war, and it's only beginning to be the case now that she's getting it.
When it comes to spycraft itself, what is she known for when it comes to the way the CIA trains today? Was there anything going on there in her work in France that to this very day is her legacy as to how people are trained to be spies?
Well, I think part of those things are the things like sixth sense and sort of the discipline of being a spy, which is, you know, hard. It's really hard to be. You can't trust anyone, only yourself. But most of all, and this is what the CIA told me on my day at Langley, was the way that she set up those networks, those early networks of volunteers and recruits, building up a system across the whole of France where that they could finally one day, when D-Day happened, spring into action and help the invading army. And the way that she set up those networks, well, she pioneered, because no one had done it before. This was all kind of new. She made it up as she went along. But apparently Operation Jawbreaker in Afghanistan, before and after 9/11, the CIA told me that, you know, a lot of the techniques that she used are used in that operation too. So it's incredible, really, that what she invented, as it were, certainly kind of not perfected, no one can perfect it, but certainly developed to the point where it was effective, that is in use today. It is really quite extraordinary.
It is very extraordinary, and it's extraordinary that no one has ever told this story before, especially the way you have, Sonia. So I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner, but more importantly, I want to thank you for writing this book and helping us understand the role of this woman and so many others in World War II. It's called A Woman of No Importance, The Untold Story of the American Spy Who Helped Win World War II. Thank you for joining us at Reader's Corner, Sonia Purnell.
Well, thank you so much.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.